gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another edition of Nerdy Notions. Today, as always, I am joined by my fabulous co-host, who still needs to work on her fabulous introduction, Caitlin Moore.
Hey, guys.
And I'm, of course, the one, the only, the ever snarky Sasha Kaplan, here to deliver what might be Caitlin's most painful movie to review so far, The Eternals. So let's start with the fact that we get this narration at the very beginning of the movie that sort of sets up the concept that we're dealing with, right? We have the Celestials, we have the Eternals, and the Celestials are, I guess, like, they create the universe. They give birth to billions of suns, which then give birth to planets, or something like that.
I already have a problem with this concept. For one, I hate text scrolls in movies. This is also why I don't like the introduction to Star Wars. Like,
shots fired, shots fired. We have a Star Wars hater. Bring in the torches and pitchforks. No, but, actually, hot take, I also don't like Star Wars, but
yeah, you're like, but it's just like, you all of a sudden in the middle of this MCU movie, well, not even in the middle, in the very beginning of this MCU movie, you have this stupid text nonsense with a bunch of basically made up words that we've never heard before, and this is supposed to be enough explanation for what is going on.
Well, we do find out what sort of happens and how everything fits in, because that's part of the story.
Yeah, we find all this out in the story itself.
Anyway, so then the story actually opens on a ship where we see these people, like, these individuals are being sort of awoken or, like, imbued with an identity. I have a note here that says, are they, like, robots or something? Obviously, we find out that they're not. They go in front of, like, this screen of, like, the back, there's, like, a back screen thing, and they have, like, they get, like, these cool costumes. Like, the costume design is pretty cool. There might not be a lot to like about this movie for you, Caitlin, but you have to admit, the costumes are cool.
That is one of the, like, three things that is good about this movie.
All right. So, we know that there's these Eternals, and they're sort of split four and four. There's, like, four with, like, active powers where they can, like, blast things and shoot laser beams, and they're, like, the fighters, right? So that is Gilgamesh, Athena, Icarus, and Kingo. And then you have the people with the more passive or, like, non-combative superpowers, which is Phastos, who is the inventor. You get Sprite, who makes illusions. There is Cersei, who... Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot Makari, who has, like, super speed, right? We have Cersei, who can transmigrate things. We have Druig, who, like, mind controls people. And then we have Ajax, who is, like, the leader, and she can heal people, and she also communicates with their, like, boss guy, Arisham. Did I forget anybody?
No,
I said Gilgamesh.
By the way, I am not going to remember any of these people's names because I honestly did not care enough. So
I wrote them down because as we get into this, I will say one of the positives about this movie is the fact that all of these characters are, they feel real, right? They're three-dimensional. They have flaws. They have unique personalities. Not all of them get an equal amount of screen time, but they don't. Like, none of them feel like they're just two-dimensional losers. Even Ajax, who has, like, the least amount of screen time and is a little stiff, we still get a feel for her personality and how she views the situation. Okay. So here's how I describe them. I have Icarus has laser vision and he can fly.
It's
right?
Superman.
One has super speed, so that's Makari. One has finger guns and energy blasts. That's Kingo. We find out that our speedster Makari actually uses sign language because the actress that plays her is deaf, which is really, really cool. Athena has, like, a laser, like, this, like, magical sword and shield thing going on. Or, sorry, Athena, not Athena. And Gilgamesh is, like, super strong and punchy. So they land on Earth. There's things called deviants who are here, like, just eating humanity for reasons. And this one guy gets eaten, but then his son is saved by the Eternals, who, like, defeat the deviants. And then the ship appears, and there's, like, different people have different jobs, so they, like, heal the sick, and they do stuff to, like, help humanity advance, ultimately. Cersei takes a like a stone looking spear and changes it to a gold looking spear, and hands it to whoever it was that she hands it to, as like, I guess, a peace offering. And then the scene sort of ends, and then they play Pink Floyd, because I'm judging, because Roger Waters is a raging anti-Semite, but whatever, it's fine. And then we get
the soundtrack in this movie is crap. Like, it is
that bad.
I hate it. I hate Pink Floyd. I hate that's how we introduced this movie, because after this scene, we basically cut to modern day, and she's seeing the dagger that she transformed 10,000 years ago on a billboard advertising an exhibit at the museum that she works at. And I'm like,
so this is the part that I'm confused about, because does she go to the museum or does she go to like a school? Because she has like a class and they're wearing uniforms.
I don't know what her actual job is, but she works at the museum as a museum teacher, I think, but it's also a school for some reason.
It's very simple. It's not important. It's not important.
Her job does not matter. If we see it for 5 hot seconds. We also know that somehow her boyfriend also works at the museum doing something.
Yeah, we don't really know what his job is.
No.
Well, I guess he could be a historian, given what we see at the end of the movie. Maybe he's a weapons enthusiast. We'll just leave it at that. He's a historian of weapons. Specifically swords, but we'll get there. So
that's the best way to describe him.
Cersei starts teaching them about apex predators and what that is. And then, her boyfriend Dane, played by that guy from Game of Thrones that everybody was obsessed with.
Yes, Kit Harington. He's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, he's cute, don't get me wrong, but I was like, oh, it's that dude from Game of Thrones that everyone is obsessed with.
And like Jon Snow, he knows nothing about what's going on.
I'll take your word for it. So the cute boyfriend was basically filling in while, he's not a science guy, but he was filling in while Cersei was like not around. Oh, and it should be noticed that she apologizes for being late to Charles Darwin's statue. Which evolution does play kind of like a very subtle role in this film. But we'll get to that when we get there.
This film is filled with heavy-handed symbolism. And it starts with the apex predator lesson, and you get into it, but it gets worse. And I think the most egregious example is Icarus. But we'll explain that as we get on into the movie.
All right, so there's like this earthquake. We see that Cersei transforms the statue that's hanging on the wall, that's like stone shell or whatever it is, into sand so as not to crush the little girl that did not apparently hear that hide under the tables order. But okay. So I have earthquake and then I have deviant in the water for some reason. Oh yeah, because we see like a deviant rising up from the water in London.
At this point, after this museum earthquake thing, they go to Dane's birthday party, and this is where we meet Sprite.
Yes.
So I believe Sprite is probably the second most interesting of the Eternals.
Ooh, okay. this is where we might have a fight of, like, who our favorite Eternal is. So Sprite is basically a young girl, but not actually a young girl, because she's been around for thousands of years. But because the Eternals don't age, she's still stuck as like this 14-year-old kid. And there's like a moment where she like takes on a disguise of this like beautiful woman to flirt with this guy. But then the second he touches her hand, because it's an illusion, it's not real, it fades and stuff. He's like, oh, what's going on? And she's like, oh, you're just drunk. And then she walks away. So we already get a hint that the way Sprite sees herself versus how she's actually perceived are two very different things, because she is not a child, but is a child. So the birthday party ends. Cersei got Dane some family crest ring thingy for his birthday. And he's like, oh, this must have cost a fortune. She's like, oh, I'm really good at bidding on eBay. Sprite says Cersei and, oh, Sprite told Dane about the whole like Cersei and Icarus relationship, and they broke up centuries ago, and that he flies, and Dane is like, this sounds ridiculous, but is there some truth to this? She's like, where'd you hear that? And he's like, Sprite told me so. And she's like, oh, good. So they go home, and on the way back, they are attacked by a deviant, which, like, are not stupid. They're not mindless.
This one isn't, at least. So, like, in the opening scene in the movie, they're kind of portrayed as, like, mindless apex predators who are hunting humanity. But this one portrays some sort of intelligence as well as an ability to heal, which plays on later on in this movie. And this is where I'll give it credit. This thing is actually threatening, especially since it's basically going up against the two of the support people. Yeah. Rather than, like, the actual combatants.
Yes. So,
and it shows, and I did actually kind of enjoy this part, it shows how useful their powers are, even in those kinds of situations, even if they're not, like, pure combat characters.
Yeah, that, like, there's a moment where Sprite, like, creates copies of herself and Cersei so that the deviant is confused.
Mm-hmm. And I thought that worked really well. But and then this scene comes to a weird careening side when Icarus appears out of nowhere and laser beams the thing into a building.
Yeah. There's also a really cool scene where there's a bus that's ramming towards them and Cersei basically makes it disappear and it looks really, really cool. So it sounds like it was a really cool scene because she transforms the bus into like rose petals or something. And Dana's just like, whoa, my girlfriend's cool.
I find it funny that we have two MCU movies with two good bus scenes, like one after the other.
What's the other one? Oh, the Shang-Chi, of course. Of course. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. This movie was so long. And so poorly paced that my brain just, like, forgot the rest of the MCU existed for a minute. So we learned that they thought that the Deviants had been eradicated 7,000 years ago, or however long it was, and that they're waiting to figure out what's next or if they're going home. But the other thing here is that this Deviant is actually very smart, and he has a healing power. Now, the only person we know with a healing power was Ajax. So... So something's going on here. So they
this
were
basically starts the movie where it's called basic. This is basically the rest of the plot of the movie, and it's called "Let's Get the Band Back Together." So
that is the official title of the episode. We're getting the band back together.
Yeah, it's very boring, and we'll get into why. But basically, they have this conversation with Icarus where it's like, you know what, the Deviants are back. We thought we defeated them all. We got to go get the band back together. So let's go talk to Ajax so that she can organize everybody.
Yep.
And then they abandon Dane and we don't see him for like the majority of the rest of the movie.
Well, because he's not important. But Dane sets up something else later that we'll discuss when we get to the after credit scene. But there is a point where Dane actually asks her like, wait, if you're Eternals and you've been around for thousands of years and you have powers, why didn't you, like, do anything when Thanos happened? And
then
basically,
they give a really stupid explanation, but at least it's a explanation.
So basically, they were told not to get involved with any human conflict, even though this is technically not a human conflict. So this is an alien from outer space, and so are you technically, but whatever. They were told not to involve themselves with anything that wasn't deviant-related. And Dane actually takes the fact that his girlfriend is an immortal being pretty well. He's like into it. Could you turn me into like a giraffe? He really loves giraffes. And she's like, oh, I can't actually like transform organic beings.
This will come back later.
Huh?
This will come back later, the organic being thing.
Foreshadow. To borrow from the Braving the Elements podcast, this is the foreshadow report. So Icarus and Cersei, we find out, broke up because he like left for reasons so many years ago, some centuries ago. She moved on. Dane is very clearly in love with her. And so Icarus shows up because of the earthquakes and decided to like look for her, whatever. Then we flash back to Babylon.
This is where we get the really long Babylon. This is also the second MCU movie in a row where we get the same kind of like action, then flashback sequence, action, then flashback sequence kind of format. And it works in Shang-Chi It kind of works here. Not really,
Works,
but
but I think that there's so much going on that it bogs down. There's like just too many plot threads that kind of bog down the film, right? And we'll get to what those are in a few minutes, but that I think is ultimately kind of the problem with this film, is that it's trying to do too much with too many things.
there's too many characters, essentially, but I will give the Babylon scene this. It gives a little snippet into each of their lives and what they're doing and what their view of humanity is. And then basically that's the run course through the rest of the movie. So from Babylon, you know, like how each person views humans overall and kind of like how that shapes their decision-making process. So from that perspective, this scene is good, but this is also the scene where Icarus and Circe get
Hold on,
together.
there's something else that happens before. There's a few things that happen before that. So Ajak meets with Scary Kirby Boss Arisham. And Ajak notices that there's something like special about this planet. But Arsham's like, girl, don't get attached, don't lose focus of your mission. And so basically the idea is that the Earth will have to give will be the birth of the new celestial, and the others don't, only Ajak knows, basically.
We don't actually learn that in this scene yet, but that's essentially what they're getting at.
Yes.
The big thing with Ajax, but other than that, it's just kind of a little bit like, again, small moments where like one of them wants to build a steam engine, but it's in Babylon on time, so it's too early. This is foreshadowing too for a really stupid decision later on in the movie.
Yeah, it's so Phastos makes the steam engine, and they're like, oh, this is really cool. But they're like, we need something a little simpler. Like, they're not ready for this yet. Which, like, he's Ajax was not entirely wrong. So they're like, how about the plow? It does sort of feel like it's basically saying that humanity didn't really wasn't able to evolve on its own, or I guess they're speeding up human evolution in this case, and innovation, because human
I'm going to,
innovation. Yes.
yeah. No, I'm going to talk about this because this entire scene I hate so much. I hate the trope where it's like humans didn't actually invent anything. It was all space aliens. And I'm like, come on. I hate it. I hate it so much because it basically doesn't give credit to humanity at
Oh, we'll
all.
give credit to humanity later, remember? Yeah.
Yeah, sure we will. But
So
it's like, yeah, they're not smart enough for the steam engine yet. So we're going to give them this plow. And I'm like, come on. Like, why do you, like, I don't understand. If you view humans and basically, like, lead on that way, you basically give us all our technology, including the day. Like, also just historically by Babylon, I'm pretty sure we had a plow. Otherwise, we wouldn't have
yeah.
Babylon. But that's beside the point.
So we also find out that Sprite essentially invented the stories of Gilgamesh and Icarus using her fellow Eternals as the storyboard. So the notion of Icarus flying too close to the sun, the legend of Gilgamesh, that was all Sprite, which, like, props for quality storytelling that transcends centuries. Athena, we find out, is very like warrior-like, played really wasted, but brilliantly played for however long we have her by Angelina Jolie. Makari, we find out, is her and Druig have this, like, there's a love for each other that is very, like, I don't know how to describe it. It's not familial. It's not sexual. It's like just intimate. You know what I mean?
I do. And honestly, I would say it's the best relationship in the movie if Droog wasn't completely awful.
Yeah, we'll get to like his weird views and how he doesn't really evolve at all, and like it's weird.
His basic mentality is the same as the bad guys in Winter Soldier is.
Yeah, a little bit.
And they never addressed it ever.
So Icarus and Cersei fall in love, and they definitely have more sex than anybody else in the MCU that we've seen, except maybe Tony Stark. But we don't really see Tony actually doing anything. We just hear about it afterwards.
We do with one reporter in like Iron Man 1.
Right, but we don't see anything. They flirt, and then the scene cuts to her getting up already, like dressed in a shirt in his bed. So we are, it is implied, and we can infer that they slept together. But here it gets a little sexier.
I hate this scene too. Because
oh yeah, I hate it.
If you look at the background, they're sleeping, they're having sex on a like sandy beach, and I'm like, okay, what, like, and like, you got sand everywhere in places you don't want to have.
Look,
sand
that's
in.
Their problem. That's not our problem.
Look, all I'm saying is that they're very uncomfortable. She at least left a very uncomfortable UTI later, assuming that the Eternals can get diseases.
I don't think they get diseases. They can be killed, but they don't get sick. So basically, then they get married in India. And meanwhile, in the present, the three we know so far, Sprite, Cersei, and Icarus, go to South Dakota. And they find out that Ajax is dead, and we are told that a deviant killed her and obviously took her power, which tracks because we saw the deviant earlier using a healing power.
So that's Ajax's character in a nutshell. She will show up one more time, essentially, in the movie in a flashback sequence, but Ajax is dead. So now it's...
There's two flashback sequences that we see her in.
Two more, I guess. Oh, right. There's the one in...
Yeah. So we'll okay. get there. So Ajax's weird like internal light ball thingy basically goes to Cersei, meaning that Ajax has chosen Cersei to lead the Eternals. And she sees Arishem, and Arishem says, "It's almost time." Then we go to something South America.
South America? Because I thought they'd pick up Klingo next.
No. In the flashback, because we have the scene where they're at the farm, and then it goes back to the flashback.
Oh, right. So they teleport them basically to the fall of the Aztec Empire, I believe is what's happening. So, and then they basically are watching the conquistadors commit genocide against the native Aztec population, wiping them out, taking them over. Is it Aztec or Incan?
I don't know. I don't think they really identify it. Or I'll double check, but it doesn't really matter so much what the conflict is. Basically, there's like fighting, and they get out of the city, and they all start. So then Athena goes weird, and they say she has something called Mad Weary, and there's no cure. The only cure is just basically to go back to the ship and like rewipe her memories and start all over again, and she doesn't want to do that, even though like they could, like Phastos could have probably done something to make sure that like certain memories are kept and certain aren't. Like, the guy's an inventor. He couldn't invent something to fix her. Seems a little weird.
This concept is brilliant, by the way. Like, I love the idea of an immortal like being weighed down by the weight of thousands and thousands of years of memories.
Except it's not just thousands and thousands of years of memories.
No, it's not. We'll get to that.
Anyway, so Gilgamesh, who is probably the character with the least amount of screen time and is very much tossed aside very quickly, unfortunately, even though he's really cool and you really didn't need to kill him, but whatever. Gilgamesh offers to watch over Athena, and Druig leaves with a mind control army because he's like, this is nonsense. We're just supposed to let humanity decimate itself and destroy things and yada, yada, yada. He's very like, it's funny because his views don't really match the way he behaves sometimes, especially later on in the film. But we find out later he's basically like a cult leader without it really being a cult, but it's still kind of a cult because he could just mind control them. It's
I'm
something.
Going to talk about him for a couple of minutes because he's probably my least favorite Eternal. So his big thing is that he can just mind control everybody so that they stop fighting. And their big problem with this is that they can't get get involved in human conflicts. Not that it strips everybody of free will and agency and the independence and consent to make their own decisions. Like, that's not the problem here. It's that they're not allowed to get involved in human conflicts. I mean, like, you basically have this person who's like, you know what? I can mind control everybody and solve all the world's conflicts. You know who also was saying that? Hydra in Winter Soldier. So the problem they have with his mentality about this is completely, like, negated by the fact, and then they basically does run a cult in the middle of the jungle, and everyone's perfectly okay with this for some reason.
I mean, look, they're a little weird. They're, like, in a lot of ways, I think they're very naive, and part of the reason for this is because they very much, they very much just, like, trust in their grand mission and design. And just to go back to your earlier point, Druk was, it is the Aztecs, because it's the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan? Tenochtitlan?
Oh, yeah. I know my history, guys.
Not my department of history. But yeah, no, it's funny because, like, he has this view, right? But he doesn't actually do anything with it beyond his little compound. Like, it almost would have been more interesting if, like, it wasn't, like, you almost don't need Arishem and the birth of the new celestial stuff. Because a conflict between the Eternals, which it ultimately kind of ends up being, is kind of more interesting. And whether that's Icarus or Druig, I think it's more interesting because it's Icarus, because I kind of... Honestly, Icarus is my least favorite. He's just so whiny and annoying.
Icarus basically is like Superman from Man of Steel, and that's actually who his character is supposed to be based off of if you read kind of the back lore of how his character was written. That being said, though, I think Icarus does have at least...
Could be worse. At least he's not Hyperion.
At least he's not Hyperion. Yay.
Yeah, so then they go back. We go back to the present, and they pick up Kingo, who was a big actor slash director in Hollywood, which is... Bollywood, not Hollywood. And he has a valet, because we need a dorky Earth sidekick. He was kind of fun, and he was like, he's the voice of humanity that is very much missing from this movie.
He's also the comic relief in this movie, because
he is also very much that.
Like, I love this entire Bollywood scene, and I love Klingo, because honestly, he's kind of the most human out of all of them. Like, he has this ridiculous thing where he's been playing in movies for, like, the last 100 years and just saying that he's part of the greatest generation of leading men in these Bollywood movies, and I'm like, yeah, this is amazing. And then the only reason he's, like, convinced to go help save humanity is because his kind of valet quotes a movie quote at him that he said in, like, what they call it, like, Shadowrun 2 or something, and I'm like, this is wonderful. Like, why can't the rest of the movie be like this?
Yeah, and what's actually really funny is that he's actually playing Icarus in the movie that he's currently filming. Just based off the costume, he's like, you see this? This is like,
yeah,
I'm you. So it's just, it's something. So the valet, it knows everything. And so they're going to Thena and Gilgamesh, who are living off the grid.
In Australia. So we're getting the band back together.
Yes. So Thena is actually drawing stuff and remembering their lives on other planets. We also learn, so then Cersei is finally able to connect with Arishem, something she'd been kind of struggling with for a couple scenes. And we learn that the Deviants...
I hate this too, because all she needs to do, basically she's just struggling to connect with Arishem throughout this entire movie. Are we shown that? No. Are we told that? Absolutely. And basically the way that she can connect to them is that Gilgamesh literally says to stop trying too hard. And I'm like, okay, do we actually show her what she needs to do? No. She just ends up connecting to Arishem for some reasons. And this is where the entire plot, like, blows up. Because if Arishem never tells her what's actually happening, The entire plan would have worked.
Yeah, well, it was kind of a stupid idea to begin with, but anyway, so we are told the deviants kill humans to prevent advancement. And that celestials are basically Arisham is implants celestials in different planets, and they use the energy of advancement, which
Not celestials, eternal. Celestials is what he is.
yes. So he makes other so this celestial Arisham makes other celestials. Yes, we're
Now,
clear on that?
the celestial Arisham makes eternals, and he also created the deviant. So
Yep.
celestial, by the way, this isn't the first time we ran into a celestial, like Ego. Peter Quill's dad is also one. So that's kind of like the
Yeah.
power of the level the beings we're talking about. And in order to give birth to more celestials, they burst forth from planets after the population reaches a certain amount, which makes it even dumber as to why they didn't do anything when Thanos snapped away half the population. Whatever.
But it's also like it's weird that like the energy of innovation and humanity's evolution somehow feeds these celestials, but whatever. So then celestials, after they emerge, they give birth to new galaxies and new life. Without them, life will die. And it's like, actually, no, without them, life doesn't get created. Therefore, there is no gain or loss in life. It's a neutral.
That's like my other, like, this entire scene is probably the crux of my big problem with this movie. One, if he never told her any of this, the rest of the movie wouldn't have happened. They kind of would have just gotten the band back together and tried to stop the big, bad, evil deviant. Fine. Whatever. The second part of this is that it goes against really their order to only involve themselves in deviant conflicts. I'm like, if the entire idea is to kind of like let humanity like grow on population and innovation, fine. I can see why not involving yourself in human conflicts makes sense. But at the same time, it's also like if the big thing is we need the human population to be a certain size, you might have wanted to step in when the Black Plague was rolling around decimating like 90% of Europe at the time, or you know, the blip, or
But
pick your favorite genocide.
at the same
Like,
time, there's not much they could have done with something as devastating as the Black Plague, unless like this,
I'm
unfortunately, whether you
saying
like it or not, the plague did help for like advance humanity. And Phastos makes this point later that anything that humans do to themselves or others does ultimately end in their help their advancement. But at the same time, if the Eternals solved all our conflicts for us, we would never have gotten anywhere. And that is explained later by Ajax when she explains this whole thing about.
except that's completely countered by the fact that apparently we got 90% of the tech or technology from these guys.
I didn't say it made sense or that it was good writing. I'm just telling you, this is how they did it in the movie.
It counteracts itself, right? Because we can't get like all of our technology from these people and then say it's humans who are innovating everything. I'm like, also,
So,
like, just how quickly would if the population would have grown if they just actually like stepped into our human conflicts?
well, it has to be natural, I guess. I don't know. But we also learn a couple of other things. We learn that the deviants are also created by Arisham, but that their job was basically to wipe out the apex predators, and then like that would let humanity grow, basically. Which makes no sense because like, what did you think was going to happen when they killed all the apex predators? Because you just created another kind of apex predator. And so the apex predator, they take over as the new apex predators, killing humanity because they've killed everything else that could be killed. And so then Arisham creates the Eternals to combat the deviants. And then they also, after each emergence, they basically get mind wiped and reset.
Yeah, so they've been doing this for millions and millions of years. So they basically go to a planet where a celestial is inside, kill all the deviants, let the population grow, wipe it all out, and then the planet wipes out, and then they get their memories reset. My question is this: since we know that there's various alien species across the world, does their appearance change with each planet they go to?
Probably, yes.
I guess that would be a cool concept. Like, is poor Cena here remembering her, like, looking like a six-tentacled alien monstrosity, like, on the planet Xenoob or whatever, trying to defeat the Deviants? Like, because that would be fascinating, and we don't get that.
Well, it's ever. Interesting because this is actually a different take on the Celestials and the Eternals in the comics, because here the Celestials create the Eternals, right, as their own children, essentially. But in the comics, and this is not my realm, so if there's like Eternal fanboys and girls, like, let us know. But from what I remember, the Celestials basically came to Earth and they like basically played with DNA and did some fun things, and that's how we got the Eternals, and that's how we eventually get mutants too. And then they did the same thing with the Kree and the Skrulls, so they're basically like God.
Which, honestly, is a much better concept to run with than whatever this nonsense is. So we also learned that they're not the only, like, group of Eternals out there in the world.
Yeah, they're not the only ones out there.
There are, like, thousands. Yeah,
we're not there yet. We're not there yet. So she calls Dane at one point. Oh no, I'm sorry, I jumped ahead. So the Eternals were created to correct the mistakes and so the Eternals were created to correct Arishem's mistake, and the Deviants actually can evolve, as we see in this movie, but the Eternals can't, because Arishem's like, if I start letting you evolve, I'm gonna be in trouble too, which we find out they did technically evolve anyway and kick the Celestial butt. So anyway, the others take this news pretty well, and then they're reminded that they need to find Makari and Druig to then decide what to do. So they go to the commune, cult, whatever. Druig is kind of a jerk to them, and then Dane tries to call Cersei, and then Cersei does call him back at one point, is like, you need to make amends with your uncle, because, like, she doesn't tell him it's the end of the world, but she's like, this is the time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an interesting observation that Kingo makes, because something is happening. I don't remember exactly what's going on, but Sprite is watching Icarus and Cersei, and Kingo basically says, wow, this is just like Peter Pan. And she's like, what the heck are you talking about? So he explains that Icarus is Peter, Cersei is Wendy, and Sprite is therefore Tinkerbell, who is like in love with Peter but can't have him because of these obvious reasons. And this, like, does sort of, like, I wish we had seen a flashback of this that set it up a little bit more. Because, like, as I'm watching Sprite, like, yeah, okay, I can see it. But at first, you don't think of it that way. You actually think, like, oh, she's jealous because she can't have, like, intimate relationships because she's stuck essentially in the body of a child when she's not a child. But Kingo sort of tilts the situation a little on its axis for us, that I wish would gotten a little bit more build up in the flashbacks. But there's no time for that.
Basically, the only reason we know this is because Klingo told us that this is what's happening, rather than us being shown that, hey, Sprite's in love with Icarus. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. It seems like everybody's in love with Icarus in this movie. For some reason. So while they're in the middle of this compound, they get attacked by deviants of a variety of shapes, and it turns into one of the fun big fight scenes of the movie. So they're all running around trying to defeat the deviants. They get split up. This is where Gilgamesh also dies, because he gets killed by the same deviant that killed Ajax, and it absorbs his powers. And Cena watches this and swears revenge, which plays on later. And this is where we also have Cersei turn a deviant into a tree,
which was really cool. I will say the design for all of the deviants is really, really well done. It's each deviant looks different, and we find out why that isn't later. But there's also something, we see the hints that Icarus knows something that he's not telling anyone, and that he's actually kind of on board with Arishem's plan. But he's worried what will happen to Cersei if Arishem finds out what they're doing. And this is like right before the Deviants attack.
Right. So their current plan is to stop the emergence by putting the Celestial to sleep, which is why they need Droog, because his powers include mind control, so we can put things to sleep.
And even though he says he's not sure he's powerful enough to stop a Celestial, but like, what other plan do they have?
Actually, this is even dumber now that I think about it, because this is almost the exact same plan we had in Guardians 2.
Mantis is able
to put Ego to sleep, and Ego is also a Celestial.
Well, at the very least, we are shown that, or told that this is something Mantis does actually have the power to do, because she helps him sleep. That is like her job.
So how is Mantis more powerful than the Droog?
Yeah, I got nothing.
Okay. Like, if Mantis was here, then this, again, would be, like, completely solved.
So Gilgamesh dies, even though he really did it. Like, he's basically old. He dies to motivate Athena to fight again, I guess. Even though, well, like, it's really not necessary. She's still a warrior. You didn't need to give her some additional motivation, because Gilgamesh was fun. I liked him.
Look, that's like, we're getting the band back together, except a member, like, we can't even all survive before we manage to get the band back together, which defeats the entire purpose of let's get the band back together.
There is also a really cool scene where Kingo defeats one of the Deviants. He, like, use his, like, little finger gun thing. He builds, like, a bigger, it was like a Dragon Ball Z kind of thing, where, like, he makes the ball bigger and bigger and bigger, and then one that was big enough, he, like, shoots it up at the Deviant. It was really cool. So then they need something to, like, boost their powers or whatever, so they need to get Phastos, who apparently gave up on humans a long time ago, and because of Hiroshima.
Because it's implied that he invented the atomic bomb, and I hate this scene.
So I don't think that's the implication, because that's not what he says. He doesn't say, I gave them this power. He says, by creating things like the steam engine, essentially, he gave way for humanity to kind of one-up him and create deadly weapons like this. Because the first time I watched it, I had the same thought you did. But the second time I did, just based off the dialogue, I got a different interpretation. Because Phastos is like, letting them evolve was a mistake, basically. Or helping them evolve was a mistake. So this is like, if a human evolution has gone too far, and I'm like, oh baby, you haven't seen anything yet. But also, I do find it a little bit, like, it makes sense that Phastos would be, like, upset by the bombs and not by, like, genocide, because not that genocide doesn't upset him, I'm sure it does, but it's, like, this is based, I mean, in a unique way, the birth of the steam engine and, you know, the Industrial Revolutions paved the way for things like the atom bomb. So for him, this is, like, directly connected to technology, and that kind of hurts him in his soul. But we need to get Phastos. So at the present day, we see Phastos actually is fixing a bicycle. And he has a kid. And he has a husband. And they're adorable. And then Icarus shows up. And his son Jack is like, hey, you're Superman. And I was like, oh God, don't let DC sue. Don't let DC sue.
Wait,
don't let
that DC means sue. That DC comics are like canon in the MCU.
As comic books, yeah, probably.
Which is great. I love that little
in
detail.
The same way that Marvel comics should be the comic books in the DC universe. Like, that
exactly.
Would be.
Exactly. Like, they get invited to his home. Probably one of the actual good scenes in this movie. They break his kitchen table, which is actually funny.
Well, because before that, Phastos is like, I don't make inventions anymore. I don't do that. I just fix my kid's bike. And they're like, are you telling me that this place isn't fortified? And Icarus tries to shoot at the window, but the window doesn't, like, absorbs the blast, essentially. And he's like, see? What about this table? Boom! That was the Fall Collection. IKEA.
It's beautiful.
It's such a human moment.
He's probably the second most human out of all the Eternals, because he's actually, you know, like, lives with them, has a family. his entire thing is devoted to his husband and his kid, and it's his husband who convinces him to go and try to save the world so that they don't all die.
Yeah, like, but at least he has, like, a better motivation for doing what he's doing. Which, like, not to say that, like, you know, the rest of them don't have a motivation, but this is a very clear, direct motivation, other than, like, we like humans.
I mean, yeah, he actually has a reason to, and that's probably my biggest problem with Cersei, is that we keep being told that she loves humanity and loves humans, and we kind of see it in places, but I wish they gave her a more, like, concrete example like they did with Fastos, because her relationship with Dane, he clearly loves her to death and will die for this woman. I feel like she does not feel the same for him.
Well, I think she, so with Cersei, we see actually her love for humanity as a whole, not individuals. Because right before her and Icarus get together in Babylon, she's actively interacting with the people. She, I think, like, just loves being around them. And so she likes working with the plants and doing the thing and helping life grow. So that, I think, gives her, like, kind of like a Mother Nature-esque vibe. So then when her and Icarus do get together, he's like, I love you and I want to love humanity the way you do, nonsense. So I think she doesn't act, because she lives so actively among humans and we see her protecting a little girl, I personally don't think I needed more of that from her, but I do think we needed more of that from Kingo. Because Kingo is weird. I like how he was characterized, but I have some issues with his existence, because as we find out shortly hereafter, his thing is like, I'm not going to go against Arishem, but I'm also not going to hurt my friends. But also, I won't stop Icarus from trying to murder you.
His biggest thing has always been kind of his family relationships. And we're getting a little bit ahead of this. I think it's important to talk about. His thing is always kind of like, the Eternals are his family. And he would do anything for his family. But at the same time, he recognizes that he believes that the celestial emerging will create billions and billions of lives. But he's not willing to kind of hurt his family over his beliefs. And I think that's actually a very good scene. He's not in the finale of this movie, by the way. He kind of just disappears from the final battle because of his beliefs.
Here is the problem, though. Icarus makes it very clear that he's going to try to stop them. Right? So this is the issue with Kingo's neutrality, because either he doesn't stop the Eternals from saving the world, good, or he doesn't stop Icarus from murdering his family. So that's kind of where my issue is. Like, I understand how he's like, I don't want to get involved with, like, whether or not we should stop the emergence or whatever. Fine. But it's the fact that he's not taking a side, essentially, between his family when one person is trying to literally murder everyone else who doesn't agree with him. But, okay, so they get to the ship. We did jump ahead a little bit, but that's okay. So we get to the ship, and we see Makari, and she's just got, like, a collection of stuff. One of which I think was the throne that, like, the king and queen get coronated, and then in England. Because that's what I think she's sitting on. And there's, like, books, and they make a joke about how she has the sword, King Arthur's sword. And Sprite says, like, yeah, he did have a crush on you. So Druig is, like, this is, again, continuing the fact that Druig is very clearly in love with Makari. And it's actually really cute, even if he's kind of, like, it's sort of like by himself, he's a danger, and he's kind of a dick. But with her, he's, like, actually human. It's kind of funny. But anyway,
kind of problem with them finding Makari, by the way, where she has been this entire time is in their spaceship. And I'm like, and the spaceship is buried, like, underneath layers of rock and sand. So has she just been there this entire time? Has she never left in, like, the last thousands of years?
No. I think what she's been doing is actually gathering stuff to take back to Olympia, even though Olympia actually doesn't exist, because that's why she has a stockpile.
How has she been leaving the ship?
She dug a tunnel. I don't know. We just
her. Like, because they have to dig it out of the dirt, and then they find her sitting there. So, like, has she been, like, how does she leave?
Maybe
How
there's
long
a part of
has
the
she been
same
there?
spaceship that had like an opening. I don't know. But basically, Phastos comes up with an like idea of linking them all to help increase one person's power to counter the celestial energy. And at first, like, oh, it's gonna be Icarus, and then it doesn't turn out to be Icarus. But so then they debate on what to do. If they stop Tiamat, who is the celestial that'll be birthed from the Earth, from being born, it prevents new planets from being created, blah, 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 blah. And then Icarus finally tells the truth. Or because he tells them that he knew about all of this entire time. Ajak told him right after they left Babylon. Ajak wanted to stop the emergence. Because, like, she'd been doing this for... I guess she's the only one that does actually remember everything. Because she tells... So Icarus goes to see her. Because he found out about the deviants coming back, and she tells him that she's been doing this for Arishem for millions of years, and she's kind of tired of it, which, like, fair. This, for some reason, something about the Earth changed her, even though they don't really explain what it is about the Earth that makes it different from every other planet and every other place. It's just like, there's something funny about these humans. But
who
we don't,
knows?
Yeah, I don't get it. So then Icarus takes, basically he's been like living with the weight of the truth for centuries. He's so whiny. Oh my God. So Icarus takes Ajak to Alaska, where I guess because of melting ice caps and something blip, which, oh, by the way, they do mention that the blip actually delayed the emergence.
They didn't do anything. Like, they full out admitted that, hey, this stupid nonsense that we didn't get involved
right,
in
but
delayed
remember,
the grand plan.
Ajak didn't know what this was going to do, right? But Ajak didn't want to stop. She wanted to stop the emergence. So Thanos arriving and snapping half the population was actually for her benefit. So the fact that they didn't get involved is actually a good thing.
Yeah, but Icarus is still like, we should support the emergence. So he would have done something. At least. Or, like, where is he?
But he didn't know.
Time?
Don't forget. A, they're all split up. And B, they sort of do what Ajak tells them to. So if Ajak says we need to get involved with this because of XYZ reasons, then they would have. But otherwise, not a deviant, not our problem. Look, it's not brilliant storytelling. Don't get me wrong. But this is the explanation we can infer. So they unfroze, they killed the deviants unfroze, they killed some oil workers, and then he basically is this thing of like how you can't go against Arishem's plan, and he pushes her off a cliff and the deviants kill her. And one of the deviants absorbs her powers, and then he uses that celestial or whatever energy. It is technically a celestial energy. To upgrade the other deviants to make them stronger and make them look different, which is the deviants we then see at that compound commune thingy that Druig had. Okay, so the emergence starts. Icarus puts on the suit. He's going to make sure the emergence happens or die trying. Ajak chose Cersei, and then Icarus confesses that he killed Ajak. They're like, wow, you're a jerk. And then Icarus leaves and Spray goes with him, and then Cersei says something about, like, somebody, I can't remember who it was, I think it was Druig, was like, well, you turned that one deviant into a tree and it was great. And Festus is like, oh, wait, you did what? Mm-hmm. Well, we could do this. And then for some reason, Cersei's like, oh, I can't do it again. I'm like, why not?
Who knows?
Right, in the same way that, like, Druig later tells her he can't do this and gives no explanation why. So, okay, fine. Like, it's so weird.
If you get into the Unimind bracelet thing, because that also bothers me.
We haven't gotten there yet.
Okay.
So, the sphere is taken from Ajax. The sphere that Ajax gave Cersei is taken by Phastos after Athena gives Cersei, like, a pep talk. Because that's the key to uniting them all. Then Drua gets taken by Icarus. They all basically go to stop the emergence, right? Icarus goes after the ship. The ship falls. Faster's actually pretty cool. He gave himself like these like gauntlet things with rings that are not the Ten Rings, that are like able to do stuff so he can fight the remaining deviant and also stop Icarus. The deviant shows up, and it's real like the deviant's entire mission is basically just like kill them all because reasons.
The deviant did not need to be in this movie.
This side plot of this like humanized deviant was very unnecessary.
Like, that could be completely cut. The only reason it's there is to give Cena something to do.
Yeah. So Phastos is taken out by Icarus. Athena goes after the deviant. She fights him. She defeats him. And then Cersei goes after to try to stop the emergence, only to Sprite then stab her. Then Druig appears and knocks out Sprite with a rock and then says, sorry, can't help you. And doesn't give any explanation. And then Athena kicks butt. Despite the sickness, she's able to defeat this deviant. Really cool how she just like slices and dices and then he just falls into pieces. That was cool at least. So then Icarus escapes, but he can't bring himself to hurt Cersei. We get that sexy flashback again. They save the world. Icarus cries because he's a whiny bitch. But then he suddenly stands like Cersei's like, so they don't explain the Unimind thingy worked because of Ajax's like ball thingy, but it also worked and explains why they survived the emergence over and over again is because they connect to the celestial energy of the incoming celestial or something like that. Right?
Right.
Sure. So Cersei like freezes essentially this celestial, and so now there's like half a head and a hand that can be seen from space that is never mentioned in anything ever.
I'm going to jump to the bracelet thing because this thing also bothers me. So the idea behind the Unimind is that they store power within themselves, and if they stop the regenerative power storing process, they can transfer it all to one individual, this being Cersei, in order to kind of turn the guy into marble. The problem with this is that it requires them to use these bracelets in order to do this. Did Icarus and Sprite put on the bracelets at any point in this movie?
No, but I think that's where so they explain that later. It was the energy from the celestial during the emergence that helped unite them all. So they all technically didn't need to put on the bracelets. But then that begs the question.
Why the frick did we do that in the first place?
Well, they didn't really know, I think, at that time. Then it was like, oh, this is why it must have happened. Because they don't really know everything. It's weird. It's not like...
Oh, like... Because I thought the point was, in order to even create the Unimind, you still need to be connected, and that they're only like the only reason that she ended up actually connecting all of them together is because she touched the celestial.
Yes.
But they were all connected, like they raise up into the sky, do the glowy thing before she does that.
But she was still touching the celestial when it happened. She was like on his like hand or whatever it is. So this part actually does kind of make sense, even though I had the same thought of like why is the bracelets not work? They didn't put on the bracelets. So that's probably why, because I guess if you have enough people connected to the bracelets, then by virtue of being next to a bracelet, it works. Okay, it's not a great explanation.
Do this too, like in the middle of like goddamn nowhere wherever he was.
I don't think so. I think the range was like too big a distance because of wherever. I don't know. I didn't write this movie. I am suffering here, maybe slightly less than you are, but
regardless, they turn this thing into marble and it is never mentioned in any following MCU movie ever again.
Yes. So then also we should know that Cersei kind of sent Icarus to kill himself.
Okay, so Icarus dies by flying into the sun. Symbolism, folks. Symbolism. You know.
Well, that does follow the story of the guy who flew too close to the sun. But
I hate that so much. Like,
they foreshadowed it earlier, so like you can't complain that they followed through with it.
Disney name is Icarus. Like, yes, obviously. Like that. That's. Oh my god. I hate that. The symbolism is stupid. It doesn't make any sense.
It's fine. As the part I found funny was they were like, when they were trying to tell Athena about herself, they're like, you're the goddess of war. I'm like, she's not a goddess, except she was worshipped in Athens that one time. Like, it's a little funny because, like, it's unclear where the legends begin and they end, essentially. But, I don't know, him flying too close to the sun, I was like, yeah, you deserve that.
Right. Created all of our myths and legends, apparently, because humanity can't create stuff without their influence, because...
Well, they do, but they don't. So
Humans are treated as children throughout this entire movie.
Yeah.
But there's something special about them.
That we don't get an explanation for ever. Oh, also, there's a funny line that I just remembered about Kingo meeting Thor as a kid that I thought was really funny.
I want that movie. I want that prequel Thor movie where it's Klingo helping Odin fight the Frost Giant battle, which is actually shown in Thor 1 way back in the day, and baby Thor following Klingo around. Like,
they make a joke about how, like, baby Thor followed Klingo around, which was really cute.
So has Klingo been to Asgard?
Well, Thor 1 was not the first time that the Norse characters traveled to Earth.
I thought that was Thor's first time on Midgard.
No. I think they explained in the first Thor movie that, like, it had happened before because they have the Bifrost. They could travel. Otherwise, how else would the humans know to worship them?
No, like, humans know how to worship them because Odin fought a war there, like, aeons ago. Now we're getting into Thor 1 backstory.
Let's move on. God. Basically, at some point, whether it makes sense or not, Thor and Kingo knew each other. And Thor, I guess, doesn't remember this. Because then Thor could have been like, oh yeah, by the way, there's this, like, dude called it that's an Eternal, and he's, like, totes on Earth.
Like, why didn't he say anything? What?
Unless Kingo made it up. I don't know. Anyway, so there is one other thing. Before the energy of the emergence drain goes away, Cersei uses her energy to make Sprite mortal. So Sprite can grow old and have kids and find love and die.
Good for Sprite.
Cersei, yep. So 2 weeks later, we're back in South Dakota, where I guess, like, Fastos's husband brought Jack over and brought food for them all.
Mm-hmm.
And they just have this, like, cute little reunion before Athena, Druig, and Makari decide to leave. There's actually a very cute moment between Athena and Jack. And Fastos is just, like, a little too overprotective. And I say this as a future Jewish mom. Like, babe, take a step back. He's like, fighting is bad. And Athena's like, how did you stop it, girls? What did that require? Oh, yes, that required fighting. So calm down. So I like that scene. Like, I feel Athena is, like, such an interesting character that they just sort of nerf and don't do anything with.
But hey, you know, the band is no longer going back together. They're going their separate ways.
This movie doesn't do a good job of balancing the amount of characters you have.
Which, like, is honestly a very hard thing for a movie to do.
Absolutely.
Like, the only reason I think they even, they pull it off to some extent in Avengers Endgame, but that's only because we know these characters so well. We've had, like 18,000 movies with them. The problem with the Eternals is that they have to introduce them, introduce their backstory, introduce their dynamics between themselves, which are actually fairly good. They all have, like, a little bit of interaction with each other. Introduce the plot, introduce the Celestials, introduce the Deviants and the Deviant subplot, which, again, could have been dropped and made this movie so much better.
It's interesting because you could either drop the Deviant plot or drop the Arishem plot.
Yeah, or introduce Dane, because now that we're at the end of the movie, so... Yeah,
hold on. So, let's see. So we find out that Fastos is staying on Earth with his husband and son. And Athena, Makari, and Druig are going to go to find the other Celestials and wake them up. So Kingo and Cersei send Sprite to school to be a normal kid, and she has a cell phone now. And then Dane has a secret. He has like this complicated family history that we don't get any info about yet, because Cersei is frozen in place, and thunder starts rumbling, and the clouds part, and Arsham is there, and he kidnaps Cersei, Kingo, and Fastos only for some reason. Even though he's like a celestial being, I guess Makari and Druid were far enough away from him, but whatever. And he tells them that he's gonna analyze Earth and judge and come back to see if they're worth it. What happens with Cersei, Kingo, and Fastos, we don't find out, because they don't return to Earth. And then basically the last scene of this movie is Dane just staring off depressed, like, oh my god, my girlfriend disappeared.
And then
necessary. I feel like you should have cut it after Arishem says we'll decide if they're worth it.
And then we get to the after credit scene.
But yes. So the after credit scene, the first after credit scene is Druig, Makari, and Athena weeks later trying to contact their friends on Earth and realizing they're not there. And they're like, what's going on? And Athena's like, Arishem, like, duh. So they're going to have to go back and rescue them. And then a small creature appears and teleports onto the ship. He is Pip. And he introduced the Royal Prince of Titan. I guess Titan's still around. Brother of Thanos. Knave of Hearts. Yeah, yeah, blah, 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 blah. Star Fox! Because we needed Star Fox.
And he's going to help them find their friends. And that's all we need to know about him.
And he's played by that, what's his face, from like that band that everyone's obsessed with, One Direction.
Oh, God. I don't care.
We don't care about One Direction.
I don't care about that scene at all. Like, I don't, like, anything to deal with the Eternals anymore. Like, I just do not care.
So there is potential to bring in people like Eros and Titan and Mentor. I don't know how that can connect to anything, because the connection that I know of this part of, like, Titan was not just Thanos, but Captain Marvel, because Captain Marvel dies on Titan.
Yeah.
And he was, like, connected to the Eternals, not to the Eternals, but to, like, Titan and Mentor and stuff. So, and, like, him and Eros were friends. So I don't know how that's going to connect to anything, but we'll see if it ever goes anywhere.
Is that this is also just part of the disconnect that the MCU is currently having. Like, MCU for the last, like, couple of movies has really been focused on the multiverse and all of that. And whatever's going on with the Eternals is, like, a completely different tangent. So while we have all these multiverse shenanigans happening in a good chunk of the MCU, we also got the Eternals doing essentially space nonsense.
What's interesting,
they don't connect at all. There's like no central theme to the MCU's arc right now, because we got it in two different, like, vastly different directions.
So we know this connects because we'll see the fruits of some of the threads that they've pulled out. But if you cut out Dane and you cut out the mentions of the blip, or even if you keep the blip, you could make this like a story that takes place in a different Earth. Is part of that multiversal saga, but they didn't do that. But we also don't know how or if or when this connects to anything. It kind of seems like because the movie flopped, they're scrapping some of this, but we'll see, I guess. But the second after credit scene is back with Dane. He opens up this weird looking box that has something called Death is My Reward on it. He's like, okay, I'm doing this. And he opens it up, and there's like the sword wrapped in paper, and he picks up the sword, and there's like cool, sketchy, whispering energy of like whatever it's saying. And then we have a mysterious voice, which is actually, I think, Mahershala Ali as Blade, telling him, you sure you're ready for that, Mr. Whitman? And that is where our second after credit scene ends. So I guess Dane will show up in the Blade movie if we ever actually get the Blade movie, because everything keeps getting delayed.
So to give context to this, he is called the superhero called the Black Knight.
Yes.
And
not to be confused with the swordsman who was in Hawkeye. Two different characters that like sharp things.
Very two different characters that enjoy sharp things. So, yeah, basically he's the story behind the Black Knight, and it's really kind of, not to get too much into comic book lore, is that he basically is an heir to a legacy that stretches back all the way. Like, he's a Camelot Knight, is essentially the backstory for the Black Knight, and then
and
he has
not
this.
always a good guy.
No, like, no, no, he isn't always, which makes it really interesting that they introduce him in this movie of all things, along with Blade. So I hope that pays off. Like, I really do, because I love the Black Knight as a character, and I hope they do him justice. They're not going to.
So it's interesting, because going off the wiki, it seems like it's not impossible, because it looks like he's interacted with, like, Excalibur and the Avengers. He interacted with Captain Britain. He did stuff on Weird World. So he does have, like, connections to stuff that's, like, different and, like, not the straight Avenger stuff. So it is possible that he can get involved with, like, supernatural stuff. I guess the sword is also, I don't know. Like, he also assisted, oh, wait. It says that taking the weapon, Dane decided to be a hero, joining the Masters of Evil, just as his uncle did. But when the intent of infiltrating them from within, this he did to aid the Avengers, but they did not trust him until he later assisted them against the King the Conqueror.
Yeah.
So, he's like, I guess maybe this will be a way to also maybe add in Captain Britain.
Which would be interesting, frankly. But that's the part of this movie that I'm actually looking forward to, is explaining what they're going to do with the Black Knight. I hope they make him a little bit more interesting than how he was in this movie. But we will see. That being said, though, this is the end of the Eternals movie, and it is a absolute slog to get through. Like, we kind of wrapped it up nicely, but literally this movie is 2.5 hours long, it feels like, or maybe 2 hours, and it feels like 8.
I believe the runtime is like 2 hours and 34 minutes or something. So it is a long movie, and unfortunately, I would say, like, it's really hard. Like, it's hard to get through this movie. Like, I didn't hate it as much as Caitlin did, so I was like, let's just watch it. And it's too long, and there's so much going on that it is actually, like, genuinely difficult to get through it. I kind of had to watch it in chunks. So, like, I watched, like, the first half hour, then I watched the first hour, and then I kind of watched the rest of it with, like, skipping a little bit just to kind of, like, get on with this. That being said, this movie did do a few things really well. Like, all of these characters, despite how much or how little screen time they have, except maybe Icarus, are very three-dimensional and are very interesting. Even if we don't like them, like, I know, Caitlin, you didn't like Druig, he's still interesting.
I will give the interesting fact that none of them had enough time to develop, really, along on top of, like, this messy plot, which is... essentially, again, we're getting the band back together to stop a thing, and then we're going to break up the band halfway through, and not even all the band gets together. So we don't even get, like, Gilgamesh interacting with Makari at all, because there's probably no more space in this movie for it. And you have, like, there's so many plots you could have cut out or done something different with, or explore more nuance elsewhere, and it's just a slog.
Remember how I said that this could have worked if it was an alternative, like, reality?
Yes.
It's an interesting IMDb note. The concept of the Earth being a womb for an unborn celestial is taken from the Earth-X comic book series, which takes place in an alternate future timeline of the Marvel Universe. The unborn celestial in the movie is named Tiamat, who is a full-grown character in the comics and is sometimes known as the Dreaming Celestial.
I hate this. If that's where they end up taking this, like, good for them, because at least it gets it out of the main MCU. But that means Black Knight isn't in the main MCU, and I want him to be.
Oh, interesting. So the film was originally supposed to end with the Eternals having their memories wiped all over again and taken into the ship Domo to set the course for another planet. However, this ending didn't resonate well with test audiences, as they found it too bleak and empty. As a result, the current ending with Cersei, Kingo, and Phastos being taken away by Arishem was added. That doesn't make sense.
That That makes zero sense. Like, whatever. Something that never gets followed up on. They disappeared into the void forever. Hopefully, he was happy with their memories and they judged the earth the right to live or whatever the hell.
Yeah.
And we'll go on from there. Happily ever after and not having to think about these people again.
Oh, this is also interesting. Three scenes apparently foreshadow the second post-credit scene. So after returning to their old ship and finding all of the things that's there, Sprite asks if she's holding the ebony blade. And Thena clarifies that it's actually Excalibur. Later, we learn that Dane has discovered his family's history and their use of the ebony blade. And when Cersei is abducted by Arsham, he decides to seek it out so he can use it to rescue her.
It's just, it's really, really weird that out of everything he is introduced in this movie, the movie that has way too much going on in it.
Gotta shove it in somewhere.
Like I think we said before, this movie, if you remove certain key components, could be completely taken out of the MCU. It's not as bad as Moon Knight in that regard, which we will get to, but...
Because I haven't spent enough time bashing Moon Knight yet.
Moon Knight is Sasha's Eternals. We will say that much.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
So,
but at least it's not our Thor Dark World.
I actually prefer watching that movie to this one. I can watch
at least
that one.
I managed to get through this movie in a way that I did not manage to get through Thor Dark World when I rewatched it.
To be fair, I've watched Thor Dark World like 3 times just because I hate myself. And each time I actually kind of like find something more I enjoy. Like this movie, it gets worse for me every time I rewatch it. Thor Dark World just becomes more and more like neutral.
I think the Eternals definitely had a lot of potential. It's not the worst movie in the MCU. I still think that's Black Widow probably or Thor Dark World.
It's Thor Love and Thunder.
The screenplay really, really needed more of a polish.
Mm-hmm.
There are 4 screenwriters credited, which was Chloe Zhao, who is also the director, Patrick Burley, Ryan Firpo, and Kaz Firpo, who I assume are related in some way. And just something didn't quite work. And it's even, I would say it's not even the amount of characters. It's the way that the story is told. And the marketing of this movie really put Angelina Jolie a little bit more front and center than she actually was in the story, which I actually really enjoy Angelina Jolie as an actor. I really wish we got more out of Thena.
Oh, I can't stand her acting. I can't stand it.
You know, to each their own. I really like her in this movie. I think she did a really good job with the character, but we needed more of this character. Gilgamesh also really deserved better, played by Don Lee.
I'm going to point out a fun fact about the casting. So, if we remember our dear Cersei, we've actually seen her actress before.
Yeah, Gemma Chan was in briefly portrayed Minerva in the MCU film Captain Marvel.
Yep, so we've seen her twice now, which is nice.
Wouldn't be the first time an actor showed up in a second role.
Yep, that is true.
But no, she was great. I like Gemma Chan. I've seen her in a couple of other things and I really enjoy her. There's just like still something like a little bit more that this movie needed that we unfortunately didn't get, and we'll see how or if in what way any of these characters come back again. And I hope they do, because at least the characters, even if the plot was stupid, the characters themselves were interesting enough that I can say I want to learn more about them. I want to see them do more and talk more and interact with like whatever it is more.
I'm glad you believe that. For me, if I never see these people again, I'd be fine. So, but overall, I would say if I had to rank this movie, it would be kind of a 3 out of 10. The plot is dumb. It is too
heavy. That's a little harsh.
I can't stand, like, I hate this movie. Like, none of the characters, like, absolutely jumped out at me that I'd watch 16 another movie with these people in it, except for the Black Knight, and he gets like 5 seconds of screen time essentially compared to everybody else. Again, you could cut out half the plot. I feel like this movie has no rewatchability and it just gets worse with every rewatch. And frankly, by the end of it, I was checking to see how much longer I had to sit here and watch this thing.
Yeah, it should also be noted that the film was not released in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, and Oman due to obvious reasons of having gays. Theaters in the UAE, Jordan, Lebanon, and Egypt actually were set to show an edited version of the film, which was missing all the love scenes, which basically means the like scene at the end where Jack shows up, audiences probably have no idea who this child is, if he even showed
Yeah.
up. But it's funny because Fastus's husband, Ben, was actually played by a Lebanese actor named Haz Sleiman, who is really great, actually. So I think we've beaten this deviant to death of a movie. But-umps. And unless we want to eternally stay on this topic, so let's fly away and wrap up. So, Caitlin, are you on social media yet?
No, I am not, but I will be starting up the Nerdy Notions Twitter soon as I get my own life together.
It is, I think it's at Nerdy2Notions, Nerdy number 2 Notions. And of course, you can find me at Geeky Kaplan on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads. Because
All
why
right, so.
not? And of course, for this show, you can listen to us on Spotify at Nerdy Notions or on txhthockey.com slash Nerdy Notions. You can also check out the archive and see some of the episodes that I did with our editor, Mike. I actually just re-listened to our Days of Future Past episode, and just when I think I'm over that movie, I am reminded why I hate it so much. But anyway, what are we reviewing next? Oh,
I forgot to ask
we are
you
actually
that.
taking a break for a few weeks because I am traveling. I am basically in a different state for the next 3 Saturdays.
So essentially, it wrecks our recording time. But what you can be looking forward to is next month will be the start of our Spider-Man saga. So we are actually going to be starting with the Sam Raimi Spider-Man 1.
Tobey Maguire, get ready. So thank you so much for listening, and please be sure to check out our previous episodes and let us know, tweet, message, thread, whatever. And let us know what you think about the show. We're happy to listen and always glad to interact with our fans.